I'm Lawrence Hill, and I'm reading from my novel, The Book of Negroes, and this is from a chapter about 100 pages into the book called And My Story Waits Like a Restful Beast. So now I'm in London, taking a break from 12 men and their swirling words. I sit alone in a separate room, spooning bee's honey into my hot tea. Down the hall I can hear the laughter of the leading abolitionist. A man who frequently removes his wig to scratch his scalp, he stands short and fierce like an exclamation mark. With me, however, he must appear solicitous. He opens his arms wide as if to comfort me with his ample belly. His name is Sir Stanley Hastings, but I think of him as a jolly abolitionist. In his musical and enthusiastic voice, he's been telling me that his wife and children have pledged to do without sugar in their tea. God willing, he says, no one in his family will drink from the blood of slaves. He says that what we really need, what would stop this trade dead in a minute, is an invention to stain all sugar products with red dye. Now he gesticulates like a man at the pulpit. Let the color of blood spoil every teacup in the nation, he says, and our battles will be over. The abolitionists call me their equal and say that we all conspire to end tyranny against mankind. Then why, I begin to ask, but they don't let me finish. I hear whisperings about property and compensation and the rule of law. I observe the massaging of palms and the interlocking of fingers. Believing I am deaf, Sir Hastings murmurs to his neighbor that I can't be expected to grasp the details in all their complexity. He turns back to me once more. Your story is one of virtue, he says. Survival has nothing to do with virtue, I reply. I'm referring to your dignity and courage, he says. We need a human face for our fight, and here you are, a woman, an African, a liberated slave who's risen up, self-taught. For 20 years, he goes on, British parliamentarians have extinguished every abolitionist fire. But this time, he says, a woman like you could make all the difference. The tension makes me tired. I don't care to fight. When I lower my voice, they all lean forward. I say, I can't speak to your parliament or meet your king without addressing the bondage of my people. The men keep pressing. Any talk of outright abolition will unite planters, shippers, traders, and insurers. Can I not see that it is men of property who vote in parliament? But I am too old for cleverness. I cannot speak against the slave trade without condemning slavery, I say. Make the arguments that you must, I tell them, and let me make mine. So we're stuck with this problem. The abolitionists keep plotting. Already there are talks of hearings into the slave trade. And one day, when the hearings are done, they will introduce yet another bill in parliament. They say they can win this time, and I do want them to prevail. Their way is better than the alternative, but their way is not enough. The abolitionists may well call me their equal, but their lips do not yet say my name, and their ears do not yet hear my story. Not the way I want to tell it, but I've long loved the written word, and come to see in it the power of the sleeping lion. This is my name. This is who I am. This is how I got here. In the absence of an audience, I will write down my story so that it waits like a restful beast with lungs breathing and heart beating. John Clarkson whispers that they cannot go on exhausting me like this. The abolitionists all rise from their chairs. We've finished our talks for the day. The men come to me one by one, full of handshakes and salutations. At the end of each meeting, the abolitionists bring out little gifts. At the last meeting, I received a book, a newspaper, and a piece of hard yellow candy with two peanuts inside. This time, Sir Hastings presents me with a new quill and a glass inkpot decorated with swirling lines of indigo blue. I love the smoothness and the heft in my hand. I rub the surface, but the indigo is buried deep in the glass. Englishmen do love to bury one thing so completely in another that the two can only be separated by force. Peanuts in candy, indigo in glass, Africans in irons. Standing too close and bumping into one another, the abolitionists escort me down to 18 Old Jewry Street. Down the stairs I go, and out into the heart of London. I take hold of the offered arm, and John Clarkson walks me back to his house. He lives nearby. These days it takes me time to cover two city blocks. People stream by as we inch along, but that does not matter. I am still upright, and I am still walking. Back in John Clarkson's home, I will have a bit of bread with some sharp cheddar. I like all foods with voices. Mangoes, Malagueta peppers, boiled ginger with honey, rum. John Clarkson's wife was quite scandalized when I first asked for it. Rum? After a snack and a nap, I hope to pick up my quill. If I live long enough to finish this story, it will outlive me. Long after I return to the spirits of my ancestors, perhaps it will wait in the London Library. Sometimes I imagine the first reader to come upon my story. Could it be a girl? Perhaps a woman. A man. An Englishman. An African. One of these people will find my story and pass it along. And then, I believe, I will have lived for a reason.